Eric Metaxas here. Please join me in a life-saving mission to set Sudanese slaves free through Christian Solidarity International. Since 1995, CSI has freed more than 100,000 women and children from years of bondage and abuse. Your $250 gift frees, feeds, and heals these captives and sets them on a path to a new life in freedom. Please help us free another slave now. Call 888-253-3522, 888-253-3522, or click the CSI banner at MetaxasTalk.com, MetaxasTalk.com.
Metaxas Show.
Are you afraid of ventriloquist dummies? Do they just creep you out because they seem alive?
Well, don't touch that dial.
Because you know that one dummy that scares you the most? The one with the dead-looking eyes? Yeah, him. Anyway, if you turn this program off, he'll pop out of a cabinet when you least expect it.
He's in there now, listening, right now.
Shh, he can hear us.
And now your host,
take it away, big dummy, Eric Metaxas.
My favorite of
all right. Hey, folks, it is snowing in New York City. I don't know if it's snowing where you are, but I have to say, Albin, first of all, in this hour, we're going to be talking about the theologian Karl Barth. So when we come back from the break. But in this segment, I want to talk about a couple things. First of all, two things. I want to talk about Paul Sorvino and Harvey Weinstein. I don't normally talk about this stuff, but this really got to me. This is a big issue
for
me.
Well, yeah, especially because you have a daughter, and I have a twin brother who has three daughters.
Part of where I'm coming from, so you've got three nieces. Okay.
Yes, three nieces. Well, I have many nieces, actually, but my twin has three daughters who are three of my nieces.
Right. Mm-hmm. And, I think that one thing we don't talk about, this is what feminism has brought into our culture, and this is why I am not a feminist, I don't think. In other words, I think feminism pretty much has twisted it's a big story. My friend Alice von Hildebrand, the great dame Alice von Hildebrand, says she's a fierce enemy of feminism. And if you want to hear her talk about that, you can go to the Socrates in the City event with her. Really, she's amazing because she's a big proponent of women, but she's anti-feminist. Yes. Very interesting. But I guess my point is that what I write about in my Seven Women book and what I write about in my Seven Men book in the introductions to those books is that we have really screwed up God's idea of what a man is and a woman, right? Now, I would say that male strength, rather than say, oh, male strength is used to harm people, so it's bad, so men should be weak. No. Men should use their strength for God's purposes, right? And so that means that men don't use their strength for themselves to be selfish. They do what they're supposed to do. With every gift God gives us, it's meant to be used mainly for others. And so men are supposed to protect women. So if a man bothers my wife or my daughter or any woman around me, they should know that I will kill them or that I will come after them or that they – in other words, they would know that they better not even think about it because I'll go crazy and they will be sorry. Now, most men in history have had that attitude toward their sisters, toward their mothers, toward their daughters, that if somebody goes near them, I'm coming after them.
Right.
My daughter doesn't have to defend herself. I'm going to kill that guy, right?
Right.
Now, that's kind of the normal way society has progressed. And so in some ways, I think Christians screwed this up by thinking that, well, it's my job to be like Jesus, and Jesus didn't kick anybody's butt. Well, that's not exactly true. In other words, the idea that if somebody had tried to slap around his mother, do you think that this carpenter guy would have said, well, I'm going to turn the other cheek? No, he'd turn the other cheek if somebody hits him.
Right.
But if somebody attacks an innocent person, the normal, healthy thing to do is to protect the weak. That's what God gave men strength for. Now, am I talking about vigilante justice? No, I'm not. But at the same time, when we act as though my job is to – I'm just supposed to pray or I'm supposed to – traditionally speaking, men go to war to sacrifice their lives for their families, for their children, for their spouses. You don't send your wife out to the battle. You do that. Now, it's become somewhat politically incorrect to say that. I definitely don't care because what I'm saying is eternal truth, okay?
Right.
If God's given you strength, he's given you strength for his purposes. And in Scripture, God says that men are supposed to stand up for the women around them. Now, a lot of women say, I don't need a man to do that for me. I don't need a man to do it. Well, like, I don't really care if somebody wants – my daughter could say, well, I don't need you to do that for me, Dad. And I would say, well, I really don't care. I'm going to do it. It's the right thing to do. Now, my daughter doesn't have that attitude, nor does my wife, nor does my mother, nor do most women I know. They don't have that kind of, you know, I would say knee-jerk cultural attitude that's like, I don't want a man to do anything for me. That's absurd. That's absolutely. It's right. Like saying, I don't need an army to protect me. You don't? Let ISIS come in and rape your kids and threaten to cut your head off, and then you're going to say, I don't need it. You know, in other words, This is just a lot of bluster. So the other day in the news, and I want to play this clip. It actually was just yesterday. What am I saying? Today's Thursday. It was yesterday. Paul Sorvino, the father of Mira Sorvino, who was threatened by Harvey Weinstein, and then eventually when she rebuffed his sexual advances, God bless her for doing that, she did that, he blackballed her, and she has pretty much not worked in the business. She's an amazingly talented, beautiful actress, and she has not worked in the business.
Academy Award winner.
So Paul Sorvino, who's played tough guys in Goodfellas and in other movies, like whatever, he was found in a parking lot by TMZ. I have no respect for TMZ, by the way. But they found him and they got this clip. And I want to play the clip. This is Paul Sorvino, the father of Mira Sorvino. Here's what he said.
What was your thoughts when you heard about Harvey Weinstein derailing your daughter's career by actively trying to blacklist her from Hollywood?
If I would answer you, I might put everybody in jeopardy. But if I meet him on the street, he ought to hope that he goes to jail. Because if we come across... I think he'll be lying on the floor somehow, magically.
Funny you should say that. So today,
whoops, let me get that. Help me there.
Today, we actually reported that the DA is making strides in their case, trying to bring criminal charges to Harvey Weinstein.
He's going to go to jail.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah. That's not a good. Good for him if he goes, because if not, he has to meet me, and I will kill the mother. Real simple.
Have a good one.
All right, thanks. Take it easy.
So did you know about any of these accusations before?
I did not.
Did you learn about this the rest of us did?
No, the extent of it. No, I did not. I sure didn't.
What was your initial...
If I had known it, he would not... Would you take that? He would not be walking. He'd be on a wheelchair.
Right. What was your initial reaction when you heard the allegations that were made?
Oh, furious.
Right?
Absolutely furious.
You proud of your daughter?
My daughter's a wonderful person, courageous, and a wonderful human being, and doesn't deserve to have been treated that way by this pig. So, this pig will get his comeuppance. The law will get him. He's going to go to jail and die in jail. But if he doesn't, Harvey, come here. I have some news for you. I'll just slap him around. I won't do anything terrible.
Okay. Yeah. Now, I think a lot of people, when they would react to that and say, well, I don't know if that's what a man is supposed to be. I think because I know a lot of people listen to this program are, you know, devout Christians, and they would say, well, that's not godly behavior or something like that. I would humbly disagree. I really think that men have abdicated their role as protectors, as knights, just because the culture tells you that, oh, chivalry is outdated. Truth is never outdated, okay? So if you're talking about men being, patriarchal in an unpleasant sense. Okay, that I can go with that. But I think men, and I think most men in America get this, that you're there to protect your sisters, your wives, your daughters.
I wonder why Mira didn't go to her father and say, hey, Dad, you know what?
I'll tell you why. Yeah. Because she probably thought her daughter would kill Harvey Weinstein.
Yeah, well, that's what just popped into my head. She probably thought, my dad's going to end up in jail because he's going to kill this guy.
Right.
And there's no way of stopping him.
Right.
She knew her father would protect her.
But I think that people like Harvey Weinstein need to know that if you behave like this, there's a very good chance somebody's going to come after you. They should feel threatened in that way, that if you behave that way, you're going to get it. And I think that somehow in the world as – I mean, look, we have to understand where does feminism and feminist anger come from? It comes from men behaving badly, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if men behave badly, then women say, well, you know what? Male strength is my enemy. I want men to be weak. I want to be strong. I think that that's getting it wrong. In other words, I think that God's idea is that male strength is to be used for his purposes, which is selflessly to protect women, to bless women. We're supposed to lay down our lives for our women, right. For women, for our wives, for our families, and on and on and on. Okay, when we come back, we're talking to Mark Galley,
yes,
from Christianity Today. By the way, Christianity Today has not even mentioned my Luther book. I'm not going to ask him about that. I don't want to put him on the spot, but it's so bizarre. I can't figure it out. Anyway, when we come back, we're talking about the great theologian Karl Barth.
Great.
Thanks for listening.
If I could fly like birds on high.
Folks, it's the Eric Metaxas Show. I have, as promised, the joy of speaking with Mark Galley. He's the editor-in-chief at Christianity Today, author of a lot of books, including the brand new one, Karl Barth, An Introductory Biography for Evangelicals. Mark Galley, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you. Glad you finally had me on after all these years.
I was going to say all these years. I've been doing radio for 2 years.
Yeah, oh, I see. Okay.
And I only now realize that you. I mean, the book is just out, but
exactly.
You don't have a million books out. I know, you're kidding me, but I take it so seriously because I don't like to laugh. Okay, so Karl Barth is such a fascinating figure. For those listening who have no idea who he is, give us the thumbnail sketch, if you would.
Karl Barth is arguably the greatest Protestant theologian of the 20th century. He helped Protestant theology take a significant turn in the early part of that century. It had been captivated by what is now known as, now called 19th century liberal theology, which emphasized the fatherhood of God, the brotherhood of man, denied much of the miraculous of in the Christian faith. Was more a humanism with a Christian veneer is what it was. And Barth came along and basically made classic Christian orthodoxy a legitimate part of the theological discussion, certainly in Europe at first and then in America.
And of course, I mean, I only know about him because of his influence on Bonhoeffer, but Bonhoeffer was, anybody who's read my book knows that part, that Bonhoeffer was surrounded by German 19th century theology, that Berlin was the bastion of that, and
yeah.
Karl Barth, 1917 and years following, just changes the landscape, and Bonhoeffer quickly became a devotee of Barth, met him, and really became friends with him, actually, but. I mean, I think people have gone on and on that he, Karl Barth, was, you know, perhaps the most important theologian in centuries, not just in the 20th century. I mean, he's a big deal.
Yeah, he's right up there when you start mentioning names like Aquinas and Calvin and Luther and Barth. I mean, they're in the same sentence easily. Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so what was it about Barth? Was it mainly his intellect? What led him to see that the God of the Bible is real, that this is not just that the Bible is not just a series of texts, but that there is a God behind the text who breathed these texts, not to say the bubble we call the cosmos, into existence.
Yeah. I think his biggest, it isn't obvious. That's why we're talking about it.
Right.
He puts himself in a stream, a venerable stream of Christian theologians who more or less basically take the Nicene Creed seriously. So again, we're talking about Augustine and Aquinas and Calvin and Luther and Jonathan Edwards and onward it goes. So
I thought Nicaea was after Augustine, or actually did they overlap? I forget.
No, Nicaea was 383. Augustine was late, was later than that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
just keeping you honest, man.
Thank you.
Yeah. You're keeping me honest.
So that's one of his, and he does so in a way that is what I guess the word thorough would be. I mean, his Church Dogmatics runs something like 8,000 pages, in which he is. And the other thing about it, it's not only thorough in the sense that he covers the full, as much as he could in his lifetime, the full gamut of Christian theology. He grounds it biblically. He takes the Bible very seriously. His formal doctrine of the Bible has been questioned, I think rightfully so, by evangelicals, being a little squishy. But his actual use of the Bible was quite impressive. And he takes the Bible with utmost seriousness. And he uses the Bible to ground his theology in a way that brings not only depth to the traditional doctrines that we have believed in for some centuries, but then some fresh and vigorous insights into the nature of who God is. And I suppose from one of the reasons I wrote it for evangelicals is an emphasis he brings to the table on the revelation of God in Christ. I mean, evangelicals are, rightfully so, people of the heart. That is to say, we are born. We have a born-again experience. We experience Jesus personally in our lives. But that type of subjective religious experience needs to be checked by something outside of itself. Otherwise, it just wanders off into all sorts of strange religious behaviors.
Right.
And Barth grounds his theology in the fact that what's important about the Christian faith is not something that happens inside of us, although he doesn't disagree that something will happen inside of us, but it grounds it, the foundation, the metaphor is not quite right, but that it's something that comes to us from the outside. And it's something that should not be mistaken for something that goes on inside of us, but it's something, it's God's revelation in Jesus Christ. And if we looked at Jesus Christ, at his life, death, and resurrection, then we begin to understand something about who God is, rather than looking inside of us and saying, oh, this must be what God is like because I feel this.
Well, it's just huge. And as I say, at a time when, Bonhoeffer was surrounded everywhere you look, you know, by disciples of Schleiermacher and all of the German textual critics who did not see the God in the Bible, behind the Bible. Suddenly, Karl Barth says, no, there's this magnificent, infinite other, and we have to deal with this other, this God. It's not just us. And I guess I'm curious, what is Barth, other than your book, which is a readable biography of Karl Barth, did Barth ever write anything that we would consider readable, or was it all academics?
There's just a few things that he wrote that actually are readable. One of them is his exposition of the Apostles' Creed called Dogmatics and Outline. That's pretty readable. His book, Evangelical Theology, An Introduction, is his lectures he gave, especially here in America, when he visited in the early 1960s.
I didn't realize he lived that long. How long did he live?
Yeah, he lived till 1968. Yeah.
Huh. Oh, that's so, right. That's right.
And then there's collections of his sermons. They're good. They're nothing to write home about. They're fine expositions of Scripture. But the things that I think most people find accessible and stimulating would be especially his Dogmatics and Outline.
Not to be confused
with Stanley Hauerwas says he reads that once a year.
That's Stanley Hauerwas.
So that's Stanley Hauerwas.
Let's not forget that Stanley Hauerwas is himself not easy to read.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
That might not be a recommendation.
Now, what I find amazing about Karl Barth is the towering intellect, that his Church Dogmatics ran to nearly 9,000 pages. I had no idea.
Yeah, yeah.
9,000. I mean, anybody can write a 6,000-page book,
right?
But 9,000. That's magnificent.
As an editor, I will say, as I've made my way through them, I will not admit to have read them word for word.
No,
but I do try to read. I go through periods where I'll read them as part of my morning devotional time, because his theology is not just technical, but it's very often inspirational in the best sense of the word. But I will say, as an editor, he could have used an editor. His sentences run on and on. And he could say he repeats himself.
He couldn't find an editor willing to read the 9,000 pages, probably.
Really?
Exactly. What year did his Church Dogmatics come out? Or did it come out in stages? I'm guessing it came out.
Yeah, basically, they are his lectures to his students over the years, starting in early 1930s and ending with his retirement in the early 1960s. So he would basically prepare a lecture by writing it out. He would give the lecture, and then he'd turn the lecture over to a publisher to do a little bit of editing and get it ready for publication.
So that's interesting that he was multitasking. He thought, I'm not just going to talk to some students. I'm going to publish something, and I'll read it to the students, and that's good enough for him. He's a complicated figure. When we come back, I want to talk to you a little bit about his personal life, something that's always puzzled me. His relationship with Bonhoeffer, this is my only connection to Bart, really, until now with your book. But he had an interesting relationship with Bonhoeffer and couldn't understand when Bonhoeffer sort of goes over to the dark side. He thought he was suspicious of him. It's just fascinating. We're going to be right back, folks. I'm talking to Mark Galley, and the book is Karl Barth. That's B-A-R-T-H, an introductory biography for evangelicals. We'll be right back.
You got that hold over me. Long as I got your love, you know that I'll never leave. When I wanted you to share my life, I had no doubt in my mind.
Taxes show. What a great, great pity that the captain and Tennille had not written this song long before they did, because these lyrics could be speaking to Karl Barth personally. We're going to go into that part of his life right now. Mark, I have to ask you, I've always been so puzzled that Karl Barth comes across like a serious Christian, but he did have adultery in his life, and it wasn't just a weekend. It was something that he was living. Tell us about that. It's so strange.
Yeah. He basically fell in love with one of his assistants in the late 1920s, and they apparently had a very powerful romantic relationship. There's still some debate whether it was ever consummated, but it's hard to believe that it wasn't. But it was certainly a very powerful emotional affair at any rate, to which he readily admits to Charlotte, this woman, Charlotte von Kirschbaum, and he admits it to his wife. And he tries to figure out a way to manage both of these relationships in his life. There was talk of divorce for a while. That was finally refused on all parts. And in the end, Charlotte comes to live with the family. I don't believe they shared a room at that point, but it, as you can imagine, that creates tremendous heartache for Nellie, his wife. And Barth does take trips with Charlotte when he does a study leave, and he goes off and spends it with Charlotte rather than his wife. So I wrote about this in the book, and it was after the book was published that some new documents have been released that helped me understand a little more deeply what was going on. Some of the things that help with the context, this is not by any means meant to justify what Barth did, but it does help us understand maybe some of the emotional dynamics of his life. He had fallen in love with a woman when he was younger, but his father forbade them from marrying, and he had to break that off. He eventually marries Nellie, who, from what I gather, it was something of an arranged marriage, so it wasn't somebody he'd fallen in love with. Apparently he was not unhappy with her, but it was hardly like an emotionally fulfilling relationship for him. In fact, he was still so deeply moved by this first girlfriend of his, our first love, that after she died early in life, I don't know the circumstances, he still visited her. He visited her grave every year. So he was deeply touched by that relationship. So when he falls in love with Charlotte, there's a connection there that's obviously meeting some sort of emotional hole in his life that overpowers him. And what I discovered in these new letters that have come forth is that he is so overwhelmed by this relationship that he does something or he says something that essentially contradicts his entire theological project, where his theological project is about not letting your emotions and not letting your experiences determine what you think God's will is, what God's truth is.
Right.
He specifically says that this relationship with Charlotte cannot be of the devil because essentially it feels so good and right. So he refuses to abandon it, even though it's clearly against the teaching of Scripture, which comes to him from the outside, and it's pretty clear of that. You shall not commit adultery. So what's shocking to me as his biography was that how easily he justified it on grounds that completely contradicted everything else he was trying to do with his life as a theologian.
Mind-blowing. I mean, it is it's really humbling, isn't it, that somebody who understands these things so well intellectually would not be able to live it out. I mean, because, you know, anybody who is married, you understand marriage is sometimes not emotionally fulfilling and it's difficult. And so the idea that this man uses that to justify, it seems to me, being very selfish and crushing his wife and having this woman move in with them, that's just magnificently selfish, it sounds like. I can't even really understand what I'm...
So, what it reminded me of, I'm a person, it sounds like you are as well, who basically thinks of theology as something that will help me live my Christian life more faithfully.
Yeah.
And it does do that. I think it really can do that. What it shows, though, is that we need more than good theology. We need prayer. We need Christian fellowship. We need all sorts of things to help us live faithfully. And theology alone is not going to cut it.
I think that's what I admired so much about Bonhoeffer is that he understood this. He understood that if you can't explain what you believe to children, then what is it worth? I mean, you can write 9,000 pages, but... do you believe it? Do you believe it to the point where you live it? And that's really the litmus test, of course, because when you say you believe something, the proof is in the pudding. Are you willing to live it out? If you're willing to live it out, people say, well, I guess he really does believe it. But we have, I think that's part of the problem with evangelicalism is we've adopted this rationalistic enlightenment view. So we say, if I apprehend this with my mind, that's faith. And the Bible doesn't really define faith that way. It defines faith as, do you put your trust in God, not do you believe he exists? And it's just one of these eternal conundrums of human existence. And with that, of course, we're going to go to a little B.J. Thomas to lighten things up. Folks, I'm talking to Mark Galley. The new book is Karl Barth, An Introductory Biography. Check it out. We'll be right back.
But there's one thing I know. The blues they send to meet me won't defeat me. It won't be
It's the Eric Metaxas Show. You can tell by the Neil Sedaka music. I am talking to Mark Galley, the editor of Christianity Today, editor-in-chief of Christianity Today, and the author of many books, including the one that we're discussing right now. My dear friend John Wilson, whose opinions I revere except with regard to politics and Finnegan's Wake and James Joyce generally. John Wilson has written this about this new book on Karl Barth. He says, it's old news by now that evangelical theologians are reading Karl Barth with great appreciation. Not as well known, maybe, is the groundswell of interest in Barth among evangelicals outside the scholarly guild. For these readers, I think that's most of us, for these readers, Mark Galley has written a refreshingly concise, warm-hearted, and plain-spoken biography of Barth that also serves as an introduction to his theology. Bravo. And I say bravo to you, Mark, because anything that John Wilson likes, except for James Joyce, I think must be great. It must be great.
There you go.
You know, he thinks Finnegan's Wake is great, and of course he's wrong. It's just pretentious. But Karl Barth, it really is one of these figures that he needs to be humanized. I think that many people have been longing for a book like yours. What is it that prompted you finally to sit down and create this work?
Well, a couple of reasons. One is he's been influential in my own reading and Christian life. But also I did recognize that there were an increasing number of evangelical theologians who had been taken with Barth, and that their teaching and thinking was going to make its way to the pews at some point. And I just felt like for those people in the pews who are interested in theology, that they might want to have a better understanding of Barth. I mean, you know, I tend to traffic with people who are intellectually curious and interested, and they cannot possibly keep up with every important thinker and writer. And if you're like me, I from time to time will read an article or a book that will help me get me in touch with someone's thinking or theology or their impact, just so that when I'm in conversation with another person who brings up that name, I won't be completely mystified and lost in the conversation, but will actually even be able to engage it at some level.
Right, right, right.
And I have written the book on Barth just for that. I mean, I think if you read this book and you go no further, you will have a fairly good grasp of who Barth was, what he was about, what his project was, and how evangelicals tend to think about that project. Now, the fact of the matter is, when people finish it, I've heard more than one reader say, I didn't expect this. I expected to read the book and put it down, but when I was done, I did want to read a little bit more. So they're starting to find their ways toward the Dogmatics and Outline or these other books I've recommended.
That's, of course, as an author myself, that's the most wonderful thing, when you really feel like somebody has appreciated your book so that they, you know, they wish it didn't end, or it's introduced them to a subject. When people say to me that I've read Bonhoeffer,
yeah, the most surprising comment was my daughter, my oldest daughter, who not only read the book, which was an amazing for my family, but then said, "I think I want to read more in Karl Barth." So that was the biggest compliment I had gotten.
I
knew if I won her over, I was going to win a lot of readers over.
it is extraordinary. Now, what do people who aren't evangelicals make of Karl Barth? In other words, in the academy today of mainline Protestantism, which I think theologically has gone off the rails, but what do they make of somebody like Karl Barth?
Yeah, that I wouldn't necessarily be an expert in that. My impression is that he is passé. That is to say, his day has come and gone, and the way he did
kind of like Shakespeare.
Not even Shakespeare, because even Shakespeare is considered someone what we might return to for literary insight.
Well, I was being sarcastic.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he's passé. His way of doing theology is no longer appropriate. His dependence on the Bible, you wouldn't call his a literal reading, but a serious reading of the Bible is not necessarily something people want to do in the academy these days. They want to overlay any reading of the Bible with a discussion of hermeneutics and all sorts of arcane and abstract philosophizing.
Yeah, because the Bible on its own scares the heck out of them.
Well, there is that, yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing. So what are some of the strange things that we should know about Barth? I mean, was he raised in a seriously Christian home?
It appears so. Yeah, he was raised in a home that we would describe as evangelical. I mean, they would describe it in his day as pietistic.
Yeah.
But a very kind of warm, warm faith environment. He talks about he has fond memories of having Bible stories read to him, and what an indelible impression they left on him. He talks about reading the stories of Mary and Joseph in Bethlehem, and his feeling that he could almost imagine himself being there. So he does have a warm personal faith to him. It very rarely comes out in any of his writings, however. he's not only wrote the Dogmatics, but he's considered a dogmatic writer.
Right.
The way he writes, it's almost like he's pounding the table.
Yeah.
But as you get to know him, you realize that that's kind of a German style of writing, a German theology style of writing, in which the theologian perfectly accepts the fact that if someone disagrees with him, they will come back with the same
That's you're right about that. That's we've just got seconds left. I don't want to forget. He wrote the Barman Declaration.
Oh yeah.
We forgot. Declaration,
which is a declaration against Hitler and fascism of his day, without mentioning the name Hitler or fascism. In other words, he critiques it purely theologically, but so clearly.
Let's when we come back from the break, let's talk about that, because I really can't believe that I waited till the end. Hang on, folks. We're going to talk about the Barman Declaration. Some of you know, if you read my Bonhoeffer book, you may know this was a seminal document in the Confessing Church, and it was written by the guy we're talking about, Karl Barth. We'll be right back with Mark Galley.
Hoping happiness will come, that's not the way, it doesn't pay. If you want happiness, just help yourself to some. Why don't you try to take life the way I do?
Yes, it's easy for Maurice Chevalier to say that, but I think the rest of us think that Bobby McFerrin had a similar sentiment, and it was equally banal and ridiculous. We're talking to Mark Galley. Mark, I've said it 100 times now, and I may be mispronouncing it. How do you pronounce your last name?
Galley, as in a ship's galley.
Galley. Now, you're sure about that?
Yes, I think I am.
I don't know who.
But I won't be offended if you say Galley.
No, I say Galley. I've been saying Galley, and I'm tempted to say Galley. Gee whiz and Galley. Well, let me ask you. We just have a couple of minutes left here, but Karl Barth wrote the Barman Declaration, fortified with strong coffee and a Brazilian cigar. That's how he put it.
Yeah.
He was the man who wrote the words of the famous Barman Declaration, which effectively creates the Confessing Church, Bekennen der Kirche, which Bonhoeffer famously was part of, and Niebuhr and so many other heroes of the time and some non-heroes. But tell us about how he got pulled into writing the Barman Declaration.
Well, he was one of the few pastors in theologians or pastors in Germany that were speaking out against much of what Hitler and the fascists were doing. And they had various conferences leading up to the Barman conference. And at a conference at the city of Barmen, they drafted essentially a declaration of the theological reasons why they were adamant about resisting Hitler and fascism. And what I think is interesting about it is not only are some of the few Germans Christians who stand up against Hitler, but they do so in a way that I think we would do well to take some lessons from here in America. I mean, it's been the rage, and a good one, that Christians be involved in social justice issues. But most of the time we get co-opted by political language when we want to talk about these issues. But the thing that's interesting about Barman is it's a theological declaration.
Right.
It begins by saying Jesus Christ, as he's attested to us in Holy Scripture, is the one word of God which we have to hear and which we have to trust and obey in life and death. And this is a an almost direct refutation of Hitler's claims for himself.
Right.
So although Hitler's name and fascism is never mentioned in this document, and it's in a purely a theological document, the Nazis heard it absolutely clearly as a repudiation of their ideology, and
right.
the signers of the Declaration were subsequently persecuted for it. I think we'd be wise as a church to think a little more deeply theologically when we want to make statements of political import. I think we'd have a much more unique voice in the conversation, and we'd actually have a much more profound voice.
It is a challenge these days to figure out how to square that circle, and people are struggling with it, and I'm one of them. But I appreciate your saying that. That's very, very important for us to understand that we have to stand apart from politics. Doesn't mean we shouldn't be involved in politics, but at the same time, we can't make an idol of politics, and many
there
people
is that,
have.
And then we have to think a little more deeply about what we have to say to any given issue. I mean, the issue of immigration, I'm personally pretty committed to us having a little more open borders when it comes to immigration. But the only theological thinking we do about that is we quote a verse from the Old Testament about welcoming the sojourner.
Don't get me started. Whenever people quote that verse, I think, for God's sake, you're taking it out of context. It's a good thing we're out of time, because otherwise we'd be talking about immigration. Mark Galli, thank you for coming on. The book is called Bart, A New Biography. Grab a copy.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.